Thank you. As David said, I'm going to be out here for a while. I've been out here for about 2 weeks now, and I've had a very good time so far, and hope to continue to interact with the different people here. So the talk today will be about how difficult is quantum many-body theory. So a large part of condensed matter physics, high energy physics, quantum chemistry, and other fields is devoted to finding ground states of quantum Hamiltonians or studying dynamical properties of quantum Hamiltonians. And you can then ask, well, how difficult is this problem? And the answer, well, I will give certain answers to it, and I will show that for certain problems there are good algorithms and that you can even in fact prove that some of the existing algorithms will be effective in certain situations, and that there are other situations where there's good reason to believe that there is no effective algorithm for solving the problem. One of the main lessons of this will be a relationship between the difficulty of the problem and the amount of entanglement present in the problem. So I'm going to spend a fair amount of time quantifying entanglement in systems by means of entanglement entropy. And tomorrow at Q Station, I'll be giving a more detailed presentation of how some of the proofs of entanglement entropy bounds go, if you're interested to come hear that also. 2:15, I think? 2:15, okay. So just for definiteness, I'm going to spend a lot of this talk talking about a one-dimensional system. So it's going to just be a system of one-dimensional spins on a line, which I'll label 1, 2, n. So there'll be n spins on a line, and each of these spins will be spin a half, so it can be sitting in a state of up or down. And so there'll be a total of 2 to the n states. And you can imagine then that you want to find the ground state of some Hamiltonian on the system. Since there's 2 to the n states, the Hamiltonian will be a 2 to the n dimensional matrix. And so if you want to go diagonalize this Hamiltonian by brute force, the time it will take will be some power of 2 to the n. And so it will take an exponential amount of time in the size of the system. So this will not be practical for any decent sized system. It's called exact diagonalization, and it is used in condensed matter physics, but the system sizes that you get are very limited, in many cases too limited to see the kinds of interesting behavior that you want to see. On the other hand, the kinds of Hamiltonians I'm going to be talking about are not arbitrary Hamiltonians. One of the important properties is that I'll be talking about local interactions on these systems. So I'll be talking in particular about nearest neighbor interactions. A lot of this machinery that I'll be discussing would work fine if the interactions were second neighbor, third neighbor, any finite range, even exponentially decaying. But again, just to keep it very simple and concrete, I'm going to assume that we talk about nearest neighbor interactions on this. So the Hamiltonian H is going to be a sum of interactions that couple nearby sites. So sum over I equals 1 to n minus 1, little h of I comma I plus 1. Where this Hamiltonian, h of I plus 1, is just an interaction term that couples site I to site I plus 1. So it might be a spin-spin coupling or something like that. So a lot of these Hamiltonians will be nearest neighbor. And this will lead us into the idea of locality. I'm going to discuss what's called a Lieb-Robinson bound for locality, which is a bound on the group velocity present for Hamiltonians of this form. And in fact, for, as I said, a much larger class, this is much more restricted than the most general class under which you can show those. So this bound on locality from the Lieb-Robinson bound will play an important role in showing that certain problems are easy and, unfortunately, in certain other cases, that certain ones are hard. Finally, one last thing before I actually get into the talk. I'm going to be using the language of computational complexity a bit to really quantify how difficult some of these problems are. And I'm going to discuss 4 common classes of computational complexity that computer scientists would talk about to quantify the difficulty of problems. And then I'm going to be going through different problems in quantum many-body theory that I can ask about this 1D chain, time-dependent problems, problems of finding the ground state, and so on, and show that each of these computational complexity classes, there are certain natural problems that you ask about the chain that fall into them, and some of them will be easy and some of them will be hard. So the simplest class is a class of problems where you can solve it in polynomial time. So the time to do it will be some polynomial of this system size n. If you want to have an approximate algorithm, if you have an algorithm that, for example, finds the ground state with some error, you would also like it to be polynomial in 1 over the error. So if you can't do it exactly and you can only do it approximately, you'd like it to be polynomial in that. And I should say polynomial time on a classical computer, meaning, for example, the sort of thing you have on your desktop. some examples of things that you can do in a polynomial time, you can sort numbers. If you want to sort n numbers, you can sort them. One way to do it is you just go through and find the smallest, then you go through again and find the next biggest and so on. It's not an especially good way to do it, but does it in a time that's polynomial in the problem size. Another interesting one you can do in polynomial time is, this is a classical problem, a completely classical problem. So I'm going to again write a Hamiltonian, but this will be for classical spins. And it will be a sum over spins I and j, some interaction jij, si, sj, where this si will be, say, plus or minus a half, and some magnetic field. But this jij will all be less than or equal to zero. So all the interactions will be ferromagnetic. The magnetic field can be anything. You can find the ground, you can do this in polynomial time. You can find the ground state in polynomial time. It may not be obvious how you do it, but you can do it. So even if you don't know how to do it in polynomial time, it would still fall in this class. So another example of something you could do in polynomial time is testing primality of a number. The next class I'm going to mention, oh, and I should say, just to give a hint of what will be a problem in quantum many-body theory that falls into this, a problem in quantum many-body theory that falls into this will be simulating time-dependent dynamics on this chain for a time of order 1. Simulating for a time of order 1, the time-dependent dynamics, and doing it polynomial in the error and in the chain size.
Can experiments like AIJ fixed, or it could be random?
It could be anything. It could be anything. Anything. As anything you want, as long as they're ferromagnetic.
But do you want the continuity? What are you
saying? Well, so for example, any observable on the chain that's on any small number of sites, I can tell you, I can give you a representation of the wave function with polynomial resources. I can write down the wave function to within any error of the ground state wave function, assuming that the wave function at time zero is nice, like starting at time zero, it's a product wave function. I can write down the wave function at a time of order one. I'm just talking about the pure state evolution of this thing, starting from a given pure state and then evolving it. So that's something you can do in polynomial time, is dynamics to a time of order 1.
I mean, a quantum system like you've written here, all ferromagnetic, let's say,
yeah.
There's no sign following. I mean, on a Monte Carlo,
I mean, if you can guarantee that, for example, you know, it will indeed not get stuck. I mean, this may be glassy because of the magnetic fields.
Yeah.
So you know, right. So I mean, if you could. No, I mean, the way you show it, there's an explicit algorithm, which is it's a network flow algorithm that solves this one fast. Yeah, in the classical case. No, actually, this one, even if it's not one-dimensional, you can do fast. Yeah. Yeah, this one, arbitrary dimensions, any jij, you can do fast as long as they're all negative. Alan Middleton has actually gotten a lot of interesting physics results out of studying this, because it's glassy and you can find the ground state fast.
But H is going to be bigger than J.
Yeah, otherwise it's boring, yeah. So another one that you can do, another complexity class that I'll talk about, is ones that you can solve in polynomial time on a quantum computer. So one example of this, sort of a famous example, is factoring a number. However, perhaps the most useful example of something that you could do in polynomial time on a quantum computer is simulating a quantum system. In fact, for example, simulating the dynamics of this chain for an arbitrary time, not just a time of order 1. So you just have your quantum computer exactly do the dynamics of this Hamiltonian. It would hardly be worth going to the effort of building quantum computers if all they were useful for was factoring numbers, but probably this is the best application, would be to simulate time dynamics of systems like this for time larger than of order 1. So that's going to be a problem in quantum many-body theory that falls into this complexity class. For the next complexity class, this one I'm going to give it the formal name, NP. So this is a class of problems where you can check. Yeah?
That last statement implies that it's not solvable in polynomial time.
Well, so this is, it's a big unsolved question, you know, can you really prove that there's no polynomial time algorithm on a classical computer, which will, for example, even for this, with a time arbitrary time-dependent Hamiltonian do the evolution, no one's ever found one. If you did find one, it would mean that all these other algorithms, like factoring a prime number, could also be done in polynomial time and on a classical computer, because you could simulate this quantum computer that would do it. But nobody's ever shown that. However, the important thing is to realize that if you could simulate this for an arbitrary time, then you could do all those other things you could do on a quantum computer, which gives you good reason to think that simulating this for arbitrary time is hard, or at least harder than you can do on your classical computer.
The quantum computer would be able to simulate an arbitrary Hamiltonian of that type, or
yes,
to design one for a particular Hamiltonian?
Well, I mean, you would... I guess you may be asking like an implementation question, but I would say if you've really built a universal quantum computer, it should be able to simulate a Hamiltonian like this. Well, I mean, I guess that's sort of an implementation question. It's like asking... Yeah, I mean, in the early days of computers, I guess a lot of things would be hardwired. Well, nowadays, everything is done in software. So perhaps the early quantum computers, if we ever get one, will to some extent be hardwired and will be better able to do certain Hamiltonians than others. So I think it's a... an example of... So the next class I'm going to call NP. So these are yes-no decision problems. And they're questions of the form, does a solution to this problem exist? And if it does, you can check it quickly. So take this Hamiltonian here and relax the constraint that J is less than or equal to 0. So again, take this classical problem. And no longer require that J is less than or equal to 0. And this problem, you can ask the question, is there a state of those spins that has an energy less than E for some E? And if there is such a state, then it could be proven to you very quickly because someone could just write down that state and you could go check it. So this is what NP is. It's these class of problems where you can check the solution quickly, but you have no way of, as far as we know, quickly finding it. You can just quickly check it. This problem is also what's called NP complete, meaning that if you had a way of quickly finding solutions to this, you would have a way of quickly finding solutions to all the problems in NP. So it's a reason to believe that this one is hard. Just that... Yeah, little h could be anything. Well, then it would be an easy instance. It's only if you can solve all of them that we say that, you know, yeah. It's if you can do all of them, if you have an efficient way to do it. Yeah, yeah. So an example of a problem in quantum many-body theory, and then I'll get to this one that will fall into this class, will be the problem of approximating the ground state energy of a Hamiltonian on that chain under the assumption of a gap. So it will be if I were to give the precise definition, I would say, is there a state of some of that Hamiltonian H over there with energy less than or equal to E, given two promises? The first promise is given that there is a gap in the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, and we'll see that this is very important. The gap in the spectrum of the Hamiltonian will constrain the amount of entanglement present in the ground state, and that's precisely what will let us find, what will let us efficiently check the solution to it, because we'll have an efficient way of representation of representing the ground state. So given gap delta in spectrum, so that'll be a gap between the ground state and the first excited state, and given an additional technical promise that if there isn't a state of energy E, the next one has state energy E plus epsilon, which just has to do with the fact that we can only approximate the energy this way. So I won't write that technical promise down. That's a minor point. So this is where the gap and the entanglement is going to come in. The point is that if the Hamiltonian has a gap in its spectrum, it will be possible to efficiently write down the ground state and to efficiently check properties of it using what are called matrix product states. And then this will be a demonstration that such a Hamiltonian, I should be pointing at the quantum one over there, will be in this class NP. And then the last class I would write down is a class QMA. And these are classes of problems where if there is a solution there, again, yes, no, you can efficiently check it on a quantum computer. and checking it, the proof of it will be receiving some quantum state. So examples of problems in QMA will be problems of, is there a state of a quantum Hamiltonian without any gap assumption? Because if there is no gap assumption, the way you can check that there is a state of energy less than something, someone could just give you that state and you could go measure the energy of that state. So an example of a problem in QMA is precisely that same problem without the gap assumption. So depending upon whether or not the gap assumption is present, the difficulty of this problem will change. If the gap is assumed on the 1D Hamiltonian, then it's in NP. It turns out if you don't assume a gap, the problem is not just in QMA, but it's actually QMA complete. It's as hard as any problem in QMA, and probably has no efficient way to solve it in general.
I can understand. So if someone gives you a variation of a wave function and you try to calculate the energy.
Yeah. So it needs to be a wave function where I can efficiently calculate the energy, and I'm gonna.
I mean, so if you could do it with something Monte Carlo.
Yeah, if you.
Then it's T.
Well, if your Monte Carlo was. If you could do what? Find that variational wave function, or?
No, show if there's a state, show there must be at least one state with energy less than T.
Yeah.
Yeah. Variational wave function with energy less than T.
Right, but how do you find that variational wave function? So the way I'm going to.
The question was, is there?
Right. So what I'm going to discuss is I'm going to discuss that given the gap assumption for that, there is a good variational wave function, but we don't know how to find it in general.
Checking the solution might be one thing.
It's answering whether there is one. Yeah. Okay, so, sure.
So does this gap classify all possible problems?
No, I mean, there are bigger complexity classes too. Yeah, these are bigger, there are even bigger ones than this. So these are, for example, when I said you could solve this in a time exponential in n, that's a class called exp time, which is even bigger than that, so.
What is QMA stand for?
Quantum Merlin Arthur.
Quantum what?
Merlin Arthur. The idea is that, you know, Merlin is this all-powerful being who can find this state, and Arthur is this ordinary man who happens to have a quantum computer who can test whether Merlin found a good state for him.
You could be Alice, though, huh?
So now I'm gonna, having kind of set this up, I'm gonna go back through and discuss how the dynamics of this chain relates to these different complexity classes and how different problems fall into different complexity classes. And so I want to just start with the first case, which is this question of doing the dynamics of this chain to a time of order 1 and show how we can explicitly write down a good approximation to the ground state with only polynomial resources, meaning how much work we do and how big this approximation is, how tough it is to write down, for this state, if we evolve it under even a time-dependent Hamiltonian here, for a time of order 1. So what's going to play a crucial role in this is what's called a Lieb-Robinson bound. As I mentioned, a Lieb-Robinson bound, which is a bound on the propagation of information in this chain.
You're starting with just some arbitrary initial state?
Oh, yeah. Well, sorry. I want to start with some nice initial state, say a factorized state, for example, for simplicity.
It's obviously not an eigenstate.
Unless the eigenstate is a matrix product state of lower rank, in which case we can still do it. So let me just start with a factorized state, and then I'll be explaining matrix product states later. I'm sure you know. But if it's a matrix product state with fairly low bond dimension, this would also work. But let's assume the initial state is a product state. So each spin is just pointing in some definite direction. And we want to evolve it under this Hamiltonian now, which will couple the spins and change the state. So I want to put one more constraint on this Hamiltonian, which is a bound on the strength of the interactions. So I'm going to assume that all these little hi are bounded by some interaction constant J. It just measures how strong the interactions are. And given this, there's a Lieb-Robinson bound which tells you how fast the influence can propagate across the system. You can prove a statement to the following. So let's suppose we have an operator A, which is just some operator that acts on spins. And we define A of T by the usual Heisenberg evolution, e to the I h t, A e to the minus I h t, like that. And so initially, A might, for example, be an operator on a single spin. And then as time goes on, because the Hamiltonian dynamics will couple A into other spins, it will spread out and will act over a wider and wider range. So a Lieb-Robinson bound is a bound on how fast it spreads out. So let's suppose we have now two operators, A and B. And let me suppose that A is sort of localized on some set of spins here, and B is localized on some set of spins here. And there is a distance L between the spins that they act on. So initially, they are separated in space. Then a Lieb-Robinson bound is a bound of the following. It says that A of T, B, you take the commutator, and then you take the operator norm. Oh, I guess I skipped over. When I said operator norm here, I should be careful to define that. Operator norm for a Hermitian operator is just the absolute value of the largest eigenvalue. For a general operator, it's the absolute value of the largest singular value. So it just tells you some measure of how big the operator is. When the operator acts on a state, the resulting state has a norm that's at most the operator norm. So I'm going to have a bound on the operator norm of this commutator. And if I say that that operator norm is small, that will mean that commutator is small. So the bound on the operator norm of the commutator is going to take the following form. There's some constants, C, so it's less than some constant C times the operator norm of A times the operator norm of B times okay. So there's constants C, U, and V, where V is a velocity such that this commutator is bounded by C times the operator norm of A times the operator norm of B, and now we get to the interesting part, times this mu times L minus VT, which means that if, minus mu L minus VT, which means that if L is bigger than VT, this exponential will tell you that this commutator is small. So for L greater than VT, this Lieb-Robinson bound is an effective bound and tells you something about how big this is. And in case you're wondering what these constants are, well, they come out of here, where I assume, for example, that the interaction was second neighbor in this bound J. So V will be of order J. In this case, it's some numeric constant times J, constant of order unity, not really that big. So this is just a lot like the light cone bound you're used to in quantum field theory, but now it's not a strict bound that says there's a velocity V, but things can leak outside the light cone a little bit in this case, but only by a small amount.
If you could just send more than one dimension,
Well, okay, there's you have the bound, the Lieb-Robinson bound is just as good as getting things in more than one dimension. And in fact, I wrote it as exp of minus mu L minus VT. It's actually even sharper than that. This is just the most convenient way to write it, because for exponentially decaying interactions, this is what you get. But for finite range interactions like this, it turns out it actually gets even sharper than that. So up for L less than V times T, you have no bound. But when you're outside the front, you find that it's actually even sharper than exponentially sharp. So, and it looks, in fact, more like a Gaussian even in 1D. So it's really a consequence of the fact that the interactions are finite range that I'm just writing this slightly more general bound, which would also work for exponentially decaying interactions.
That term does not require 1D.
No, it does not. And in fact, this mu, if you have exponentially decaying interactions which decay with the range mu, it's the same mu as here. So this is the Lieb-Robinson bound. And now what I want to discuss is simulating dynamics on this chain. And what I'm going to discuss here would work just as well for time-dependent Hamiltonians, and I'm sure you'll see how to change it for time-dependent Hamiltonians, but let me write it down for a time-independent Hamiltonian for simplicity. So you have something like exp. Just, I'm going to write down the evolution operator, exp of I integral from 0 to t h dt. So this is just evolving. This is some unitary transformation which I want to act on that initial state with. And what I'd like to do is I'd like to break this Hamiltonian into two parts, which I'm going to call h naught and h prime. And the two parts, h naught and h prime, and let me write this chain a little bit longer because I'm going to need some more sites. H naught is going to include some of the bonds, and H prime is going to include some of the other bonds. So we're going to go and take something of length 2L, where I'll tell you what L is later. Something of length 2L, I'll tell you what L is later. And then I'm going to skip a bond, and then I'm going to take something else of length 2L. Let's make all my 2Ls the same. Skip a bond, something else of length 2L, and so on. And the terms in the Hamiltonian that couple these sites, I'm going to put into H naught. So this is going to be H naught. On the other hand, the terms that act on here, I'm going to call H prime. So that's going to be H prime. And I'm going to do something that's just like going to the interaction representation. I'm going to treat this as a bare Hamiltonian, and this is a perturbation. So I'm going to write this guy this exponential in terms of separate out these two different terms. So it's going to be equal to like that. So first acting with H naught, and then the other one is going to be, let me give myself a little more room. Might even need more room than this. Okay, sorry, I squeezed that in a bit. I should have given myself just a little more room there. But what we have is first we're acting with H naught, and then we act with H prime. But we act with H prime, it's integrated over times T prime from 0 to T, but we multiply it by exp of I H naught T minus T prime and exp of minus I H naught T minus T prime. So this is just the usual perturbation theory. So this is the bare Hamiltonian, this is the perturbed Hamiltonian, and I've just written it in terms of an integral. I should put the integral dt prime in here. And this is a t prime ordered integral. That's what that t prime denotes. So it's ordered in this t prime. So should be just a standard thing in quantum mechanics. So here I've written it like this. And now this exp of I h naught is nice because each of these intervals here doesn't talk to each other in h naught. They're completely separate. So I can go work out exp of I h naught as a unitary operator that acts on this interval, one that acts on this interval, and so on, one that acts on each interval separately. So I can write that as a product over intervals of some unitary operator u of the interval. So that's what this is. So it's just something that acts on this interval, something that acts on this interval, and so on. How much work do I have to do that? The amount of work I have to do that is exponentially large in the length of the interval, because I have 2 to the L states on this interval, and I need to go diagonalize this Hamiltonian H naught on the interval, write it down, work it out, and figure out what this unitary operator is. Now I go to this term here, this H prime, and then I have this interaction representation with H naught on each side of it. And here I'm going to use the Lieb-Robinson bound. The Lieb-Robinson bound, well, I originally wrote it for this Hamiltonian, but it would work just as well for the Hamiltonian H naught. And since it would work just as well for the Hamiltonian H naught, let me sort of write it down pictorially instead of going through the math from here to here. So you have some term in H prime that acts on this bond here. When you dress it by going h prime and this e to the minus I h naught and e to the plus I h naught, you'll find that this term is actually spread out over some wider range. But because of this Lieb-Robinson bound, you can approximately truncate that spreading out to an effect that's localized within a distance L here, as long as L is larger than V times the time you want to simulate for. And you can do that for each bond. So then I have this, let's draw this better here. So I've taken this bond, this one gets spread out, and then I skipped one here, and this one gets spread out, and I want to have them all spread out just enough that they don't quite touch each other. So this bond here, it will spread out and will be an operator acting here. This bond will spread out and will not quite overlap with this one. This bond down here will spread out and will not quite overlap with this one. Maybe I should just draw the picture again because it's starting to get a bit overloaded. Oh yeah, that'd be good. Use some colored chalk. Okay, so let's draw the intervals that go into H naught of length 4. And these operators U on the interval are acting just on these ovals I've drawn here. Then you take this operator on a bond here, and you realize, well, it spreads out due to H naught, but it will only spread out by roughly an amount V times T. And if T is short enough, I can constrain that so it's, say, spread out over to here. This one is spread out over to here. This one is spread out over to here, and so on. And they don't quite overlap with each other. So to a good approximation, I can pretend that they completely don't overlap with each other, and I can write down a set of operators I can just completely ignore their overlap, restrict this to act just on here, and throw out everything that acts over there. And I can write down unitary operators V of the bond, which represent this integral here, and just go compute that. So a product over these bonds. And each of these will be spread out over a length scale here. And the amount of effort I have to go through to do all this is going to be, there will be, these intervals are of length 2L, so the number of states will be 2 to the 2L, different states on each interval, and then I'll have to do matrix diagonalizations of matrices of this size, but that'll just increase that by a factor of 3. So I'll have to do matrix diagonalizations of this size. L is going to have to be large enough that L is bigger than V times T so that I can make this approximation of truncating these operators to be local like that. And if I also worry about getting this to some error. There's always an error. And in fact, I should make L not just bigger than V times T, I should make it big enough that this error term down here is really small. And in fact, I should make it such that that error is smaller than order 1 over N. And going through it all, what you will find is that that the effort will be polynomial in N, it will be polynomial in 1 over the error, but it will be exponentially large in time. So you can only go for a time of order 1 before this kind of scheme is going to break down. But up to a time of order 1, this shows you that you can always do it, and you can, in fact, efficiently compute with these states written in this form. Assuming the initial state is nice like a product state, then I can compute things very efficiently given this kind of representation of the state. So I can answer really... yeah, and in some sense, in that I'm breaking it into different things. I mean, I've been trying in many cases to see ways of breaking it into multiple scales and have not yet been effective. But there's some similarity in the idea, at least, I think.
I mean, in two dimensions, it's more complicated.
Yeah, I mean, in two dimensions, the notation gets worse, really, is all. Because what you need to do is you need to break it into three sublattices such that... Right. The key thing here is that I broke it into bonds of two types. So really, in two dimensions, what you'll want to do is break it into let me write this down. So one term will include interactions within a hexagon. The other term will include interactions within another hexagon, and then the last Hamiltonian will include interactions within. This is how I want to do it. A third hexagon, so that I have three Hamiltonians meeting at a point. I'll break it into three different terms like this, and then I'll act first with one, first with this, and I'll repeat these. So the notation gets worse in two dimensions, but the procedure works the same. The trouble is that in 2D, if you want to break the Hamiltonian into several distinct parts, such that you don't want too many meeting at a point, but then in 2D you need three to meet at a point. So it just gets worse notationally, but the same procedure works. Yeah.
So I'm missing the punchline, because even when you break it up into the red and the blue operators, these operators do overlap. So when you apply them.
Oh, okay. So the blue is this, which acts first, yeah. And the red operator is e to the I h naught h prime e to the minus I h naught. So this one, I just go compute this exactly on this interval. So this term here. This term I compute exactly. This one I can certainly compute exactly. This one, I take h naught here, and I make an approximation. Since the influence of this operator is only going to spread out up to this length scale, I replace h naught by acts exactly where I know it's going to spread out to. And then I go compute this exactly on that interval. So. I act first with the red operators and then with the blue operators. And that's the reason for going to this interaction representation. So I just compute both terms in this interaction representation, the first one exactly, and the second term I make an approximation of truncating at this length scale L. Okay. So here's the way to do time dynamics for a time of order 1. In fact, in many cases, people manage to, in practice, go to timescales much larger than order 1, very large timescales. The reason is that they're not dealing with completely arbitrary Hamiltonians. Now, as I mentioned, the problem of studying the time evolution of an arbitrary Hamiltonian, this is probably harder. If you want to do an arbitrary Hamiltonian for an arbitrary time, this is probably harder. But most of the Hamiltonians we encounter within physics, you can do efficiently for a long time, because most of the Hamiltonians we encounter in physics have some nicer forms than this very arbitrary one, and things often get better behaved. And the way of doing this is what's called matrix product states, and also matrix product states will lead me into the discussion of how one finds the ground states of gapped Hamiltonians. So now I want to switch to talking about matrix product states.
Yeah.
In fact, any matrix product state wave function would work as an initial state. I mean, not some completely entangled one. So when I say simulating for time of order one, I mean that you really have to assume that the initial state is things where something where you can compute things efficiently too. Yes, but it's not too entangled because we only waited a certain amount of time.
If you didn't make an assumption about the initial state, you wouldn't even be able to write it.
Yeah, I mean, so we have to assume the initial state is something we can write efficiently. Okay, so now let me talk about matrix product states. Matrix product states are an ansatz for the ground state, which are used all over the place. There's what's called density matrix renormalization group, which basically finds matrix product states. And these are an extremely efficient way of writing down ground states of 1D Hamiltonians. So the wave function is going to be just some set of amplitudes which depend upon all these spins. So let me label them S1 up to Sn. So it's some function of these 2 to the n different amplitudes. And the matrix product state is an ansatz for it. What we do is we introduce extra variables called bond variables. So for every bond in this chain, we introduce a variable that's called a bond variable. And I'm going to label them by Greek indices, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, and so on. And each of these bond variables, so they'll be alpha, beta, gamma, like that, each of them is going to go from 1 up to k, where k is a number called the bond dimension of the system. Let me now write down the matrix product state ansatz. You sum over all these auxiliary bond variables, like this, a wave function which depends upon the bond variables and on the spins, and it looks something like this, psi alpha S1. Psi here is just a vector that depends, it's some function that depends upon alpha and S1. A alpha beta, A2 alpha beta of S2. This 2 is also an index, so it's got indices alpha beta, this 2 and S2. So it can be viewed as a K by K matrix, which depends upon the spin and upon this end. It's a K by K matrix that depends upon the spin. A3, beta gamma, S3, A4, gamma delta, S4. And you can guess how it keeps on going. And then eventually at the far end, we're going to get up to An minus 1. Sigma tau of Sn minus 1, psi Sn minus 1 of tau. So it's a sum over all these auxiliary variables of something of this form. So on each site, we have a K by K matrix. On the N sites, we only have vectors instead of matrices. And we have these bond variables that we sum over. And so each of these, so for each site, we assign 2 different K by K matrices, depending upon whether the spin is plus a half or minus a half. So we assign 2 different K by K matrices. So some examples of matrix product states. K equals 1 matrix product state is just a product state. Because if K equals 1, then there is no sum over these auxiliary variables. So all these auxiliary variables have the same value, and this is just a product of, this is some wave function of psi S1, this is some wave function of psi S2, and so on. It's a product state. An example of a simple matrix product state would be a completely dimerized state. So if we took these spins, and we imagined a state where these 2 sit in a singlet, these 2 sit in a singlet, these 2 sit in a singlet, and so on, this would be a K equals 2 matrix product state. The reason this would be a K equals 2 matrix product state, well, across these bonds, we don't need to worry about entangling anything. But here, these 2 spins sit completely entangled. So what we would do, for example, is we would make psi alpha of S1. So we would say psi 1 of plus a half would be 1. Psi 1 of minus a half would be 0. Psi 2 of plus a half would be 0. And psi 2 of minus a half would be 1. So this would just be writing down this first psi. So that tells you that this bond variable alpha is going to be the same as the spin. If the spin is up, alpha is 1. If the spin is down, alpha is 2. Otherwise, this is 0. And you would write A alpha beta such that, well, we wouldn't even need beta because we wouldn't have any entanglement across this bond. We only need to care about how it depends on alpha. So we'd write A2 of alpha of plus a half. Well, if alpha were 1, we want this to be 0. And A2 would be 1. So this would say that if this spin is in the plus a half state, this bond variable has to be 1. But if this bond variable has to be 1, we're going to force this spin to be in the minus a half state. And then we do something similar, I won't write it down, where A, A1 of minus a half is 1, where A2 of plus a half would be minus 1, and A2 of minus a half, I'll just write down A2 of alpha equals 2 of plus a half. Would be minus 1, minus 1, and then the other one would be 0. So it would say that if this spin is up, this one is down. If this one is down, this one is up. So this bond variable can be thought of as carrying information about the spin. The bond variable knows what the first spin is in, and then it uses that to tell the next spin what it should be in. If this one is up, it forces that one down, and vice versa. So this state is a K equals 2 matrix product state. Now, the interesting thing is that for not very large k, these states are good approximations to the ground state for many physical systems, like k of 30 or 100 or something like that. For any state, whatever the ground state is, you can always write it as a matrix product state with k that's exponentially large in n, k of order 2 to the n over 2. But the interesting thing is you usually don't need that big. And that's going to lead me to area laws for entanglement and so on to discuss why you don't need that big. So let me contrast this behavior with what the ground state does. So one interesting aspect of this matrix product state is to look at what happens when we cut it. So here in this dimerized chain, if you cut it here, the state just factorizes. And if you cut it here, there's some entanglement across the cut. If you take an arbitrary state, so let's look at what happens when you cut the ground state. So the ground state, let me write it as a, I'm going to need some more room again. So let me leave that up and write it over here. The ground state, and now let me write not the amplitudes, but let me write these as state vectors. So here, it will be, I'm just writing out the ground state in some basis, and that'll be the obvious basis of just specifying what each spin is. So it will be these amplitudes. Okay, so what I've written here is I'm saying that I'm going to write the ground state as just a sum over some basis states, and this basis state S1 up to Sn just specifies exactly what spins S1 up to Sn are in, and then this is just the amplitude to be in each of these basis states. So thus far, nothing new. Now I'm going to imagine cutting the system in half at, say, n over 2, at halfway along. So we could write this out exactly as sum of S1 up to Sn sine naught of S1 Sn, and then okay, so I'm writing now a product. I'm taking the entire chain, which has this nice basis set here where I specify all the spins, and I'm just writing a basis set on the two halves of the chain. So the basis set on the left half specifies what the spins in the left half are doing, and the basis set on the right half specifies what the spins on the right half are doing. So no new physics from here to here, just a rewriting. The interesting thing, though, is that now I can make a change of basis on the left and right half. This is called the Schmidt decomposition, and one can always write, and it's just doing a singular value decomposition if you want to do this, if you want to know how to do it, but you can always write this state as some sum over a new variable. Let me call it gamma, in fact, for analogy with these matrix product bond variables. And gamma will range from 1 up to 2 to the n over 2 of some amplitudes A gamma times psi left of gamma, psi right of gamma. So it will be a state on the left half and a state on the right half. Well, these states have been picked to be orthonormal, meaning that psi left of alpha, inner product with psi left of beta, is going to be delta alpha beta, and similarly on the right-hand side. So the two states will be, this will now be an orthonormal basis of states. So you can always make a change of basis such that this holds. And this is a nicer basis to work in now. It's a nice basis to work in. And generically, these amplitudes A gamma will just be the probability of it being in the different states. If it were a product state across, then there'll be one non-vanishing A gamma. Otherwise, there'll be lots of non-vanishing A gamma. Let me, for convenience, order these A gamma so that they're in decreasing order. So A1 will be the largest, A2 will be the next largest, and so on like that. So these are amplitudes to be in the different states, like this. So I'll just order them in this order. Now, what I claim is I want to relate this representation with the Schmidt decomposition to this matrix product state decomposition. First thing I claim is that this matrix product state, if you do the Schmidt decomposition, will only have k non-vanishing amplitudes A. Only have k non-vanishing amplitudes A. To see this, you just pick that cut. There's some bond variable which carries information across the cut. Maybe it's, say, the same variable gamma, for example. So you would cut the state here. And if you don't sum over gamma, but you sum over alpha and beta, that'll be some state on the left half. And then if you sum over delta, epsilon, whatever comes next in the Greek alphabet, you'll get some state on the right half, and the state on the left and the state on the right will both depend on gamma, and so you'll see that it's a sum of these k different things. So matrix product state, only k of these non-vanish. Conversely, if only k of these are non-vanishing across every cut, the state is exactly a matrix product state. So it goes both ways. Whether or not something is a matrix product state is directly related to how these coefficients decay. So there are only k non-vanishing A gamma if and only if state can be written as matrix product state. So these two are the same. To see that a state which has only k non-vanishing can always be written as a matrix product state, it's convenient. There is a lot of gauge freedom in this matrix product state in that there's a lot of arbitrariness. I can change these matrices around and get back exactly the same state. So for example, I could take a matrix A alpha beta and right multiply it by something, and a matrix A beta gamma and left multiply it by something. You see, I've just written the product of matrices in here. So I could always stick in some X inverse, and then so I can make changes in the matrices and get back the same state. You can exploit this gauge freedom to change the matrices around such that you can make the states on the left and right orthogonal to each other, so that the state specified by different values of the bond variable will be orthogonal, which is exactly that property you want over here, and then you can use that to show that there's this nice exact relation. So these are matrix product states. So now, if you want to see how well you can approximate the ground state by a matrix product state, you really want to ask how quickly do these A of gamma decay? Because in generic ground state for a real quantum many-body Hamiltonian, they're all going to be non-vanishing. But they actually all decay pretty quickly. When you write down the matrix product state, you're going to throw out all but the first K. So you want to ask how much error is there in the stuff you threw out. How much error did you make in throwing this out? So the question is really, can we quantify how these A of gamma behave, and if we can quantify how they behave, what will that tell us about the amount of error that we make? And this will lead into the topic of area laws. And area laws, okay, don't need this over here. So we need some way of measuring the amount of entanglement, and I'm gonna boil down this entire set of 2 to the n over 2 numbers, all these different A of gamma, into just a couple numbers which are called entanglement entropies. So one nice thing you can see from this Schmidt decomposition is if you trace out the right-hand part of it. So initially I started with a pure state. Now suppose you just don't look at the right-hand part and you look at the left-hand part. Now you get a mixed state. So for example, if it were two spins entangled, initially it's a pure state if they're in a singlet, but if you don't look at one of them, the other is just equally likely to be up or down. It's a mixed state. And here, tracing out the right half, you see that the density matrix on the left half, rho left, can be written as a sum over gamma A of gamma squared psi left of gamma psi left of gamma. So now it's a mixed state, and these A of gamma are probabilities. And with a mixed state, a convenient way to measure it, to measure the amount of entanglement, is with the entanglement entropy. So with the entanglement entropy, we have a mixed state, and we can just measure the entropy of this mixed state. So one thing is the von Neumann entropy, which would be S, which is trace of, minus trace of rho log rho. That's the minus trace of rho log rho, which is equal to minus sum over gamma A of gamma squared log A gamma squared. So this is the von Neumann entropy of it. The larger the von Neumann entropy, the more entangled in some sense it is. It's also convenient to define what are called Rainy entropies on the system. Rainy entropy, S sub A, it depends on a parameter A, and I'll be most interested in the case A less than 1, is defined to be 1 over 1 minus A trace of, log of trace of rho to the A, rho left to the A. Okay, so this is called the Rainy entropy, and the Rainy entropy at A equals 1 is the same as S. If you take an appropriate limit, you take the limit as A goes to 1 from below, these two become the same. So these are both ways of measuring the entanglement. For a state like a matrix product state with rank k, these are both bounded by log k. That's as big as they can be in this matrix product state. The way you would achieve that maximum is if each of these different A gamma that are non-vanishing were all equal to 1 over k. And then it would have k different states entropy of log k. It may be less than log k. So then you can ask, well, does the ground state say that? And tomorrow, I guess at the Q station talk, I'll be discussing how you can actually go prove bounds on what the ground state entanglement entropy is. So now I'm just going to use it. The most convenient one to talk about, actually, this one's a little more familiar, the von Neumann entropy. This Rainy entropy is a little bit more useful, though, because you know that if the Rainy entropy has a bound, then you know that these decay faster. Then you know that if S of A is bounded for some A less than 1, then A of gamma squared is less than some constant times 1 over gamma to the 1 over A. To the 1 over A. Yeah. So you have it, you know that you know that these decay faster than some power law if these S of A are bounded. So if you, it's just seeing that this sum stays finite. So the smaller A is, the better the bound here. As A gets very small, this tells me I have a very fast decay on the exponents. So it's nice to know that the S of A for these are bounded. And how much error do we make in our matrix product state? Well, the error we make by approximating the matrix product state by the ground state is roughly, you can get a little more precise, but it's roughly, this is the error, epsilon is going to be n times the number of sites, because we're going to make errors on every bond when we truncate on every bond, times the sum over gamma greater than or equal to k plus 1, because this is the stuff we throw out, A of gamma squared. So this is basically the error that we make. So now you can see that having a bound on how quickly these coefficients decay will tell us some bound about how much error we make in approximating the state. And if you have a good bound for A less than 1, you can find that the error here goes down polynomially as gamma gets bigger. And so what this tells you is that this is the claim I made earlier. If I want to describe the ground state of this system knowing that there is a bound on these S of A, if I know that there's a bound on this S of A, I know that there is an ability to approximate the ground state well by one of these matrix product states with a rank that goes only as some polynomial of how big the system is and how small the error I want to make is. So that tells me that. So all that you're left with doing is saying, well, how do you show that there's a bound on the S of A? And that's what I'll be to. That depends on the gap, exactly, yeah. So that depends upon the gap, the statement that there's a bound on S of A.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
Could you mention how you measure A?
How you measure?
How you determine A?
Yeah, well, okay. I mean, you can't really measure it very easily in a physical system. I mean, it's more something that's a useful mathematical quantity. So I would not say that there's a good way to go measure it. I mean, you can measure it in a computer simulation. And people have. And
like for the size of the chain, for instance.
Yeah, okay, so let me talk about what things do in physical practice. So there's this theorem that for a system with a gap, the A is these are bounded, these entropies are bounded. In fact, in practice, for lots of 1D gap systems, things that work out better than they should. In that for systems described by conformal field theory, these entropies diverge only logarithmically with the size of the system. And since they diverge only logarithmically with the size of the system, that's not very big, and so you can still have efficient algorithms or have efficient representation of the ground state. On the other hand, the worst case is worse than logarithmic divergence. So I'm not sure how much time I have left. I can briefly close or go on a little bit more, or I was... 5 minutes? Okay. Okay, 5 minutes. Let me just, since I have 5 minutes, let me show you how you prove something a little simpler than the bound on the entanglement entropy, and then close will probably take just over 5 minutes. So let me show you very briefly how you prove something simpler than the bound on the entanglement entropy. This is how you prove that if there is a gap, the correlations in the chain are short range. Now, it turns out that just knowing that the correlations are short range is not enough to know a bound on the entanglement entropy. One would think they are related quantities, but it turns out there are states with very small correlations and yet very large entanglement. I will not discuss those because I guess I don't have time. But I'll just show you very briefly because this gives a flavor of how some of the math works. And I guess some people have certainly heard me present this proof before because this is the simplest thing one can show with this Lieb-Robinson bound machinery. But this is how you show the correlations are short range, assuming a gap. Quick proof, sketch of the proof. So suppose I have two operators, A and B, and I want to show that they're expectation value of their product is small. And let's subtract off the product of the expectation values, and let's even assume that this product of the expectation values is zero. Let's just assume that's zero. So now, let me define B plus to be the positive energy part of B. It's the part of B in the basis of the Hamiltonian that raises the energy. So this expectation AB, I claim, is the same as expectation B plus. Because starting with the ground state, you can't lower the energy. You have to increase the energy. On the other hand, I claim that this is the same as the expectation value of the commutator of AB plus. Because if B plus sits over here, it, in a sense, it annihilates the vacuum from that side. So now what I want to do is I want to come up with an approximation to B plus that's a good approximation and that's local. So the approximation is something like this. I'll write B plus. Here's an exact representation, assuming you're careful about defining this contour integral. So it's a dt. It's a contour integral. So I integrate over time with this 1 over it plus epsilon, which picks out the positive frequency part. And this b of t is the same time evolution as before. Now I'm going to define an approximation to this, which I'll call b tilde plus. So I'll put in... What I'm going to do is I'm just going to put in a Gaussian. Exp of minus t times the gap squared divided by 2q, where q is a constant I'll pick later. So I've just defining this approximation. I've blurred out this Gaussian, or I've smoothed it on a scale that's proportional to the inverse. You can use the Lieb-Robinson bound to look at how this operator b tilde plus commutes with a. You say that, well, you have this Gaussian that kills things on a time scale that's the inverse gap. And so this operator only has a small amount of time to spread out and so cannot make it over to where A is. So the commutator of B tilde plus with A will be small. However, you can also use the gap. The first part used the Lieb-Robinson bound. The second part used the gap to show that, in fact, B tilde plus and B plus produce almost the same state when they act on the vacuum. You can bound the error between B plus acting on the vacuum and B tilde plus acting on the vacuum. You can bound that difference.
A and B are local operators.
Local operators, yeah. So that's used to show that this is there. And by appropriately choosing this constant Q, you can ensure that this error isn't too big. because when Q gets large, this error gets small because I start getting a better approximation. So Q needs to be reasonably large, but then Q can't be too big or A and B tilde plus would cease to commute. And by appropriately choosing this Q, using the Lieb-Robinson bound and using the existence of the gap to bound this, you can show that this expectation value is exponentially small in the spacing between them. You can then, similar tricks with a lot of input from quantum information theory can be used to actually bound the entanglement entropy, these S of A, and then that can be used to say something about the efficiency of algorithms for finding the ground state in that you know that there's at least a good matrix product representation of the ground state. So just the last thing I mentioned before I close is that this was all systems with a gap. If you throw out the gap assumption on the 1D chain, well, for systems described by conformal field theory, the entanglement entropy doesn't grow too rapidly, and you still can do it well. On the other hand, I can write down explicit systems where the entanglement entropy grows faster than that, and it grows as an inverse power of the gap. So there are systems in which the entanglement entropy grows more rapidly than you would predict from conformal field theory. Some of these systems... well, a gap of order 1 over L, let's say. Sorry, you're right. I said that in haste. What I meant to say is that let's say the gap is of order 1 over L. I shouldn't really say no gap. If the gap is of order 1 over L, so it's not really a gap in that sense, so it's getting very small. If it were described by conformal field theory, then the entanglement entropy would not be too large. On the other hand, there are other systems where the entanglement entropy is much bigger. These are carefully picked Hamiltonians. And recently, Aharonov, Gatzman, and Kempe, and Irani showed that some of these 1D Hamiltonians, which are gapless 1D Hamiltonians, the problem of approximating the ground state is complete for this large class QMA. So in fact, for those, we expect that there is no efficient way to even compute approximate properties of the ground state. So in conclusion, I guess, these different... they show it by writing down a Hamiltonian whose ground state encodes the history of a quantum circuit. So there's carefully chosen interactions, all in 1D, such that the ground state is a superposition of different time evolution of a quantum circuit at different time. And such that basically the trick from the physics viewpoint is that the left end of the chain knows about the state of the quantum circuit at early time, the right end knows about the state of the chain of the quantum circuit at late time. Highly non-translationally invariant. And it's very easy to find a state that satisfies everything in the middle. But if you want to make the state that satisfies things at the left end, you have to explicitly compute all the way to the right end and then make sure you satisfied it over there. There is an example which uses more states in 1D, so it has a larger number of states. Their example has like 9 states or something, 12 states, sorry. There's an example that's translationally invariant that has, I think, a number of states that's, I'm trying to remember, I think proportional to the, I think the number of states on a site is proportional to the chain length or something. So it's not too big, but it's...
That's a little like 2D.
Yeah, it is cheating. Well, in 2D it would be exponential in the chain length. Right. So yeah, it's a highly non-translation invariant system. So it should not be taken as evidence that no algorithm will exist for most of the physical Hamiltonians. It should be taken as evidence that in order to solve a physical problem, you have to do something that respects what's going on in the physical problem, because you will not find an algorithm that just solves every 1D problem.
Translation invariant system, which has a finite number of degrees of freedom on each side.
I don't know any example of that. I don't know any example. I know a...
I think when the system is like phase separated, you know, whether, you know, Z is equal to 2, so there's more low-lying excitations than there are in conformal field theory. I don't know if that changes things in any way.
Yeah, I mean, I know a system that's almost translationally invariant except for one defect site, which has much more entanglement than predicted by conformal field theory. I don't know if you can actually do better than what you would see in conformal field theory or not on a completely translationally invariant system. I would guess that you can, but I don't know. So. Anyway.
Okay, that's very nice. Any questions?
More questions?
Those of you who are talking, pass it by now to Mark.
Yeah.
I have a question. So what happens for the systems when I have, for example, infinitely many degrees of freedom locally? So if I have kind of the electron component.
You mean because the boson on a site may have excitations?
Yeah, some sort of bosons.
All the theorems start to run into trouble at that point. On the other hand, since most of those systems are described by things where you can truncate the boson occupation number on a site, I don't think it would change too much in practice in most cases. But unfortunately, all the machinery we have runs into technical troubles at that point.
Okay.
I hope so.